Wait, are you gaming? On a Chromebook?
Yep. It's got a high-res 120Hz display, plus this killer RGB keyboard. And I can access thousands of games anytime, anywhere.
Stop playing.
What?
Get out of here.
Huh?
Yeah, I want you to stop playing and get out of here so I can game on that Chromebook.
Got it.
Discover the ultimate cloud gaming machine, a new kind of Chromebook.
What's up? It's Kaylee Cuoco. When it comes to travel, we all have a happy place. I just went to my happy place. I just went to Maui, and it was truly amazing. Priceline has always been about getting you to your happy place for a happy price, with deals you really can't find anywhere else, like up to 60% off select hotels in Costa Rica or five-star hotels for two-star prices in Cabo.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Well, every so often, this silly venture, whatever this venture is, he goes, finds itself in situations where there's a very funny and frankly frightening mismatch. And rightly or wrongly, everyone in this room today comes from a cricketing background where you tend to hang out with, play with, speak with, and associate with people who are at your level.
Yeah.
Not today.
I'm bringing things down, am I?
Got some clubby.
Today we're in the presence of greatness, and it's greatness that, as everyone attests, has never put himself above anybody else, which is strange, and we're going to ask about that. It's greatness that fringe players and grade cricketers and fringe grade cricketers unanimously say always showed care, respect and attention to them, again, which we're going to ask about. The man we're talking about today enjoys that reputation despite having amassed 27,000 international runs from 543 matches.
Jesus Christ.
In tests, he hit those runs at 52, rounding up a bit there. In ODIs, it was at 42. First-class cricket, it was at 56. There was 356 international catches. He's the winning most test captain in Australian test history. He's also won 3 World Cups, 2 as captain. I think the country knows all of these things, but it still makes us very safe to read that out.
Yeah.
Okay?
Definitely.
Can't believe those the forearms are actually in this room. Anyway,
unbelievable.
He's now a coach and a commentator par excellence. This will finish in a sec. He's the best since Bradman. Nobody's looked better in a baggy green, in my view.
Yeah.
He's with us for an hour. He's just learnt that. And so let's commence by saying it's the deepest of pleasures to welcome RT Ponting to TGC Towers. Ricky, welcome.
Thanks for having me, guys. You can keep going if you want. If there's anything else that you can talk about and bring up from my career, then go for it. But I think you've probably crossed most things off there. But nice to be here. Always fun catching up with you boys.
That's good. That's a relief. Ricky, when you look around this decadent studio, just to kick things off here, and you ask yourself, why am I here? Did you ever in your wildest dreams from being a Mowbray boy, playing club cricket at Mowbray in the early 90s, let's say, did you ever think that, grade cricket would be the basis of a media entertainment product in the 21st century?
It probably should be. It probably should have always been, to be honest. I mean, it's anyone that's played grade cricket, club cricket, realises how big and important it is in the scheme of the world game. So, and I don't think enough attention's probably ever been paid to club cricket, to be honest. I mean, even, the modern players are probably not playing as much as once before, which I think's a bit of a shame, because I think if you can, even the back end of my career when I did play a bit more grade cricket, just to be around your local club and see what impact, even a state player or an Australia player can have on a grade club is pretty amazing. So that's one thing that's probably died off a lot, which is disappointing. But I think that, if the players actually do have a chance to sit back and take 5 minutes to have a think about where it all began and how it started for them, and if they can give a little bit back to their clubs, and I think everyone's better for it.
Who's got the most social cachet in Launceston at the moment, you or Ariane Titmus?
I think she's voluntarily got me covered. Anyway. Got a wardrobe full of gold medals, and yeah. I haven't spent much time there in the last 20 odd years. So she's, okay. I think she's voluntarily got me covered.
Have you done any mentoring with the?
I actually played grade cricket against her dad.
Really,
Steve Titmus, yeah, who was a local news presenter. Actually worked for one of the stations down there, and I played grade cricket against him, so there you go.
Any recollection of how that
I didn't remember it. I got told about it after she won all the gold medals. I've been reminded of the fact that I'd played some grade cricket against him. But I do remember him because he was, as I said, a news presenter that I knew quite well and I caught up with, but I didn't remember the the on-field battles that we had.
I'm glad to. I remember learning that he was a news presenter because they interviewed him after Ariane won gold, and I was like, "This bloke can speak." Yeah. You know what I mean?
He's an actor.
That's right. Yeah. He's got his lines ready. Yeah. But yeah, anyway.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say, "Oh, I made 120 or something."
But, scratchy early, but
he probably sledged me. You know, like most great cricketers in Tasman, I was starting off as a sort of a
9-year-old
faced, 12 or 13-year-old. I copped a little bit early doors.
Yeah. Who's this 12-year-old? Yeah. Oh, he's good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rick, doing some research for today, and as we do, we ask around anonymously. People have provide anonymous sources. So I hope you can confirm this, but I started inquiring about whether you'd be quarantining ahead of the GABA test. We're recording this, he goes, on early November. So I was told that there would be zero chance of you quarantining ahead of the GABA because you've just been in so many bubbles, right? And also Channel 7 isn't doing it either. But I was also told after a recent stint in Sydney, a maid commented that there was an unusual number of wine bottles around the room. Ponting wines, that is. And I can only guess a lot of digital wine tasting events were being held. Is that how you made your way through bubbles?
That was what I said was happening, that we were doing a lot of Zoom wine tasting sessions. But no, to be totally honest, we did do a lot of that. I was in quarantine in Sydney for those 2 weeks, and with this wine business sort of growing by the day, and we're doing whatever we can to sort of get the name and the brand out there a little bit more. So one of my business partners, David Krenich, had organised quite a few of those Zoom meetings to have with our winemaker in South Australia as well. But so he'd organised to have 3 cases of wine sent up to the room. You know, one Sauvignon Blanc and one Pinot and one. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, we've got it. We've got him here. Well, we actually discussed off air whether we'd whether we would crack it, except that it's 9 a.m. and you
never too early.
I've already had 2 beers, so it's just a change of palate.
Yeah,
not ready
yet. Yeah, it's palate stuff.
Yeah, and I laid out. So your research is right. So I had made my way through in those 14 days. I'd made my way through most of those bottles of wine, and then I'd checked out in the morning. I'd got in the car to go to the airport. David Krenich, the business partner, had to go back to the hotel and actually collect some signed bottles I'd left there. And when he got there, the maid had said to him, "It looks like they had some sort of party up in there." I've been in quarantine by myself. And the comment was, "It looks like he's had a big party in his room." So no, I did have a couple of glasses a night to get myself through. Because trust me, if you haven't done it, 14 days in the one hotel room is pretty hard work. So
no good.
Just a couple of glasses a night just to get me off to sleep, and that was about it.
Mm. Obviously, we're heading into the Ashes. That's a thing that's going to happen this year. I think every question that I could think of about your playing career, like things that you've achieved playing against England, you've probably been asked 100 times. Wickets, runs, you got Michael Vaughan at that time, Old Trafford, series victories, catches, you've done it all. I wonder if like there's something that sticks in your mind when you think about an Ashes series which didn't involve you directly playing. So like, but obviously your career spanned in the Ashes. How many Ashes did you play in? 10?
Yeah, I don't know. Actually,
a lot of them. What a great career.
Yeah, it must be nice. Yeah. It's like we're talking about Tendulkar. His career goes for like 15 different decades.
89.
Oh, 200 test matches.
200 test matches. That's too many.
So I thought I'd played a lot, and he's played an extra 2 years on top of me, basically. An extra, no, more. Yeah, extra 30-odd tests. Yeah.
Yeah. What did you play? 160?
168.
So 32 tests more.
Yeah, probably another 2.5 years of test cricket on top of what I did. So.
He was good. Anyway, I wonder if there's something that you think about in your playing days that didn't involve you directly. I'm thinking like Steve Waugh's SCG 100 in 2003, or McGrath rolling his ankle, or Nasser batting first in 2003. Yeah, is it
batting first in 2005?
Yeah, sure.
Sorry, bowling first.
Bowling first. Is there something that like, you know, you sort of think about which didn't involve you directly, but as a memory of the Ashes generally?
Oh, look, there are a lot. I think about Mark Waugh's first 100.
Oh,
it was an Ashes 100 at
91.
Yeah, at the Adelaide Oval, I reckon it was. My uncle actually played one Ashes test match, Greg Campbell, in 89, actually.
Really?
So, yeah, it's my mum's brother. So that's a memory that I have that was pretty special. Just to think that someone in my family could actually do it made my dream, I guess, a little bit, not a reality, but something that I thought I could probably achieve. If someone in my family could do it, then there's no reason I couldn't. Mark Taylor's 100 at Edgbaston in
97,
which was a bit of a comeback sort of moment for him as well.
Oh, he could not get one off the square for like 3 years.
Yeah, for a long time.
So I remember that.
To be around that team and then all of us understanding how much pressure he was under, and he was the captain at the time, and how important it was for him and the team and the series, and he got that 100. I reckon Bluey might have got 100 with him, actually, in the same game, who was a great mate of mine. So,
yeah.
I mean, Ash's memories wind the clock back as far as you like. I mean, you know, I'm 46 now, so I sort of started watching. The earliest memories I've got are probably in the early 80s of Ashes cricket. Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that sort of stands out was AB and Jeff Thompson nearly getting Australia across the line. I think that was here, wasn't it, MCG, mm-hmm. When Tomo nicked that one to slip.
Oh, yeah.
So all those sort of memories of Ashes cricket are, you know, I must admit I don't sit back and think a lot about what's happened in my career, but when you think about Ashes cricket, and I've always said, you know, the Ashes battles for me is the pinnacle of our game, and the things that I miss the most now, being able to, you know, I just wish I could play one more Ashes test. That's how, sort of how special it is to me and to all Australians and to all young Englishmen as well that grow up, you know, wanting to play the game. It's all about Ashes cricket. So, I mean, the other things that go with Ashes cricket that's not necessarily about test matches is just the time you spend on the bus, you know, on the team bus in the UK. You're there for 4 months, you know, you got another 20-odd boys and girls around you for that period of time, and you travel to the counties and you play little county grounds and you see all the old members there. Like, it is really special. I mean, they're the things you miss at the end of it.
Mm. So Ponting's about 5 this summer.
Interesting. I'm starting to get tingles just so he wants to play again. Yeah. Ricky, how are you seeing these Ashes? So, you know, the accepted wisdom is that Australia is short-priced favourites. Our bowling's too good for their batting. You know, their bowling will struggle to get 20 wickets. And yet we've not played for a year. And when we last played, we lost. And we're pretty outplayed as well. I know everyone can carry hope. But so what sort of hope for our English audience would you give England of being a serious threat and causing a boil over or taking the series deep this summer?
Yeah, I did some stuff for Channel 7 last week. And I said England can win, but they won't.
They can, but
I think a lot of the things you brought up there are spot on. You know, their batting does look frail. Technically, a lot of their batsmen look
Nicky
different. Let's put it that way. Roy Burns and
those sort of guys
look a bit different. But I mean, with Stokes being in that side now, it's a completely different looking team. We saw what he did against us last time over there. He can single handedly win games. Mm. Yes, I think Australia will win. And win well, but I've just still got this little doubt in the back of my mind about last summer, and because we said exactly the same thing last summer, didn't we? There's no, you know, our bowlers in against Indian batsmen in Australia will knock them over, and then their bowlers won't be good enough to get our batters out. Well, that wasn't the way it worked last year, and it just goes to show with the grit and determination that they showed. If England can do something like that, and if their technical frailties can be, I guess, worked out and worked over by their mental side of their game, then they're a chance to win. And I mean, we've still got a few gaps in our side that we've got to fill as well. You know, who's going to open? Who's going to bat at 5 or 6? So there's a couple of gaps there that we need to fill and sort out. But yeah, Australia will start short price favourites. They'll win in Brisbane, and see where they go from there.
5-0. Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah. I'm not so sure about 5.
And Australia never lose in Brisbane. Yeah. Who was the first beer you went to in the England dressing room after an Ashes series? Who were the good blokes in England?
You put me on the spot there.
I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah. KP.
Yeah.
Well, actually, to be honest, I do get on well with KP.
Yeah.
Freddie was always, he was always sitting quite close to an Esky at the end of a test match.
Yeah.
No, look, it's pretty fair to say that there wasn't much chat amongst teams until that last ball of the last test match had been played. But, who would I have gone to? Probably some of the younger guys that I probably was wanting to sort of get to know a little bit better. Like, I would play a lot against Strauss and Vaughan and Flintoff and Anderson and Broad and those guys. So I played a lot against them and knew them quite well. But, I must admit, I wasn't rushing to anyone's side.
Yeah, I can see the competitive flint in the eye. Just kind of.
Yeah, it works. I think it works both ways. And the other side of that, I guess, is that I didn't have a chance to play much county cricket either, so I didn't know a lot of the players. A lot of the other guys that had played a fair bit of county cricket knew the England guys probably better than me, and they would be pretty happy to go and sit down and have a beer with them. But no, that competitive edge for me was still always there.
Yeah.
I just want to bring you back to some of the doubt you were talking about with the Aussie side. I don't know if you would agree with this, but there's probably understood to be sort of five or so world-class players in the Aussie side or guys that will go down in history. You know, two or three might be greats, yet they're ranked fourth in the world in Test cricket. Has this generation of the Australian men's team underperformed? And if so, why do you think that's the case? Or if they haven't, do we just overrate the players?
I don't know if we overrate the players because there's, you know, world rankings and things like that that probably determine how we even look at the players. You know, so was, you know, Smith and Marnus and Davey. You know, they're the three sort of standout batters, aren't they? Then you look at Cummins and Hazelwood and Lyon. You look at the world rankings, those guys have been in the top 10 probably for certainly the last 5 or 6 years of their careers anyway.
You think six players in a side at that level, you'd think, well, that's a pretty good basis of a side, right?
Yeah, it is, yeah. I just think like last summer, they've just been really critical moments, I reckon, in the last 4 or 5 years. And even if you wind the clock back to the last Ashes series, even though we retained the Ashes, there are a couple of moments there, even that Headingley game that I talked about with Stokes, that you just can't understand and see how they didn't win those moments. Mm. Sydney last year against India, how did they not win that game? How did Brisbane end up like it did? You know, there's been some, you know, really glaring frailties, I reckon, for a team to be able, if they nail those moments there, then they're not ranked number four, and we wouldn't even be bringing up, you know, why with six great players haven't they been better? So it's,
why do we not nail those moments? Do you think is that like what is it coincidence or is it leadership? Because it does seem to be a little bit of a pattern. You can arm wrestle your way to outplaying other teams for a good period of time, but when the time comes to strike, there seems to be an issue there. What it seems so invisible to the untrained eye. You're the most trained eye alive.
Yeah. it seemed to me, and I've spent a little bit of time around the team the last 3 or 4 years at World Cups and whatever else. But when certainly the Test team anyway, when they've been put under the most extreme pressure, they haven't been able to get it done. Like even with Stokes in that one innings at Headingley, and you know, Ashwin and Vihari sort of putting up the brick wall in Sydney last year, when the pressure's really come on, they haven't just been able to just make that one breakthrough or get that one partnership going. That's which I think is the trademark of great teams, you know. And I think that thinking back to the really good teams that I played in, it was those critical moments that we just got right all the time. Someone would put their hand up and just say, well, okay, we're under the pump here, but I'm going to be the person that's going to change it. I'm going to get it done. And more often than not, you know, that we were able to turn some pretty tricky situations in games into really positive ones. You know, whether it was Gilly coming in at six and getting 100 in, you know, 80 balls, or
him,
or Hayden or Langer at the top, you know, getting through a tough spell against some good quality fast bowling, whatever it was. It just happened that way, and it hasn't happened that way with this current team. I don't think there's any relationship issues. I think it's just the trust that comes with a really tight quality group that have been together for a long time, and you know, even, I mean, I think Payne and Justin have done an amazing job. What they've been able to do to transform the team, the perception of the team anyway, from what the public now see and think and look at the Australian cricket team and what they did soon after Cape Town. I think they've done an amazing job there. And their on-field performances have been good without being great. And I think at the end of this summer, they've got a chance to make those on-field performances great. You know, teams' reputations and individuals' reputations are made on Ashes cricket, simple as that. So if this team can win an Ashes series at home, all of a sudden last year against India will be forgotten about, and they can start striving to be the best and number one ranked Test team in the world. So
I suppose we're talking as though they can rectify mistakes and that there might be bright skies ahead for the Australian cricket team off the back of what's come before, but I mean, I look at the Australian side, and I want to ask you about batting, because you mentioned there before you got Smith and Warner. That Smith averages 60, Marnus averages 60, Warner averages 48. It's a bit pretty bare after that. Warner's 35, Smith's 32, so he's got a little bit of time left. But does it drop off a cliff after that a little bit? Do you have any concerns about the future of Australian batting? I mean, we don't seem to have any guys coming through that are established, maybe in their late 20s, who can pick it up. If the guys start getting a little bit old or whatever, I compare that to, say, you know, the Indian, which is what we do now, but, you know, the Indian pathways and guys coming through there. Who are you seeing that might pick up the baton for Australian batting? We're lots on Will Bukowski, but he's got question marks. Mm. Where's next? Are our systems bringing through enough bats? Do you have any concerns?
Well, the first thing we shouldn't ever do, I don't think, is compare us to India, because once you've spent some time there and you see how many players they have, I mean, they've got 46 or 47 first-class teams. And the whole country loves the game. Any young kid you see in the street is playing cricket. And so they are going to have a lot of depth. And the IPL is certainly helping that, because they've got, you know, a lot of these younger players now, they're in IPL setups, they're around the best players in their country, they're around the best players in the world. A lot of them have got the best coaches in the world helping them out at a young age. They're being exposed to high-level cricket at a young age. So when, like last summer, when a lot of those guys that we hadn't heard of actually get put up into a test match, they're not scared of it. They've been around these teams. They've been around these good players. They understand the moment and they embrace it and take it on. That's what, you know, really impressed me so much about them last year. Are our pathways right? Yeah, I think they're right, because they've only gotten better over the last 50 years. So there's no reason why we can't keep producing. But, you know, we haven't for the last probably 10 years, and Michael Clarke or Steve Smith's probably the last ones that have sort of come in at a really young age and looked at home at international level. Cam Green, I think, looked at home last summer. I think he's a player. Who are the next lot? I think there are guys like Josh Phillippe, Josh Inglis, you know, Travis. I still think Travis Head has got a test match future. I still think Khawaja's in our best six batsmen in the country as well. And I've
said do you have him in the top six for the Ashes?
I think he's been in our best six batsmen from the moment that he started playing for Australia. I don't think he should have gone out of the team.
Yeah, right.
To be honest, because I think the guys that they've brought in after that haven't looked anywhere near as accomplished at test level as what Khawaja did. And I know Khawaja's away record was nowhere near as good as his record at home, but if you got someone that can average 60 or 70 in Australia, they'll work it out eventually in different parts of the world. So, look, I wouldn't be surprised if they go back to him for the summer. Nick Maddison's obviously playing really well at the moment. Whoever's got the hottest hand come selection for the first test will probably get that spot in the middle order. But there is enough young talent there, because we see that a lot of the younger players really do dominate first-class cricket. They've just struggled with the next step up to international cricket. And I think a lot of that comes with the added pressure. It also comes with the fact, I don't think a lot of them have been given a really good extended run at it either. Like, I think it gets to the point, if we haven't got a lot of talent, just work out who the best two are and give them a good crack at it for a while. You're going to have your ups and downs, but if there's no one that's a standout better player, then let's not keep mixing and matching and trying to find someone that's going to get it done. So, yeah, we'll see what happens.
With the scheduling this summer, because England have had this problem now this year with 100 introduced, they now have to split the county championship the same way we have to split the Shield season. You play three games at the top or four or whatever, and then you have the big bash for most of the summer, and then you finish the Sheffield Shield season. It's like, so Will Bukowski, for instance, if he wants to come in for the MCG, he won't have played a Shield game because he might be available by sort of mid-December, but he's playing for, I don't even know who he plays for in the big bash, one of them. So, like,
he's with the Stars, but he's never played a game of that.
Okay, too good.
Yeah.
Actually, no, it's like just ahead of yesterday, I want to thank you, because I was just watching some old clips on Roblinder 2's channel of you facing Glenn McGrath, Tasmania versus New South Wales. Yeah. You scored 126.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Absolutely smashing into Pigeon. Most of my mate Pigeon. Yeah. That would have felt
good. Can you send me that?
Hey, so look at that. The question is, McGrath overrated? Thoughts?
No, he wasn't. No, I don't think he was overrated. I think he was pretty good, but
no, that day he wasn't.
Well, that were the challenges you loved.
No, he was really good that day.
Yeah,
yeah, that were the challenges you loved. Because I'd been to the academy with him as well a couple of years before that, so I'd faced a lot of him there, and even rocking up for a Shield game and playing Warnie in a Shield game was always a lot of fun as well, but didn't happen all that often.
Mm. Yeah, how'd you go against Warren in a Shield game?
Yeah, smashed.
I don't think he got me out.
Just got to use your feet.
Yeah.
Just get forward to him. You just got to read it out of the hand.
You just got to read it out of the hand, yeah.
All right, could we pivot to you were mentioning Indian cricket and the IPL there as well. The IPL, the next season starts in about 16 weeks. So first there's the mega auction. There's two new teams. You're on record saying you're going to try and keep the Delhi family together. want to sort of curveball you there. You're going to try and keep the Deli family together, but surely you're also up for bidding vis-a-vis new franchises. You would be an extremely appealing prospect for a number of them, but... So how do you at once keep the Deli family together and then if, you know, whoever paid $20 billion for
if you're
Luck
coaching,
Now...
If you're coaching Luck Now.
Or I'm not bad. Just like, oh, what about us, Rick?
Yeah, you have done your research, haven't you? Because I'm not contracted yet. I haven't signed the contract. No, look, in all honesty, I'm not, but I'm pretty sure I'll be at Deli next year. I've loved the last 4 years that I've had there. We've gone from last first season I coached there, third, second, third. So we've had a great time and some of the young players I've had a chance to work with there have been exceptional and really good people. And that's what I want to try and be able to do again. I want to be able to, you know, the Prithvi Shaws and the Srasayers and Arvish Khans and these guys that we've had in that system for, you know, for 3 or 4 years that have really now turned into exceptionally good IPL players. And some of them have turned into really good international players as well. So, and it's not even, for me, it's not even so much about those big name players. Like if I can keep a few of those guys there, great. But it's more of the fringe players that we've had around that have just been, that have added so much. A lot of them haven't played. A lot of them haven't played a game. But when you see them in the team and at training and how hard they work and how much they enjoy it, that's what I sort of want to be able to recreate again if possible. Now with the retention stuff, you know, we can only keep 4 players and we had, I think, 24 or 25 in the squad last year. So to try and bring the majority of those guys back will be ideal, but it's going to be a challenge as well because, you know, with the retentions, you know, with the 2 new teams, you can guarantee that they're talking with IU, they're talking to Pant, that, you know, they're trying to secure these guys and lock them in as you know, generational franchise players, if you like, and it's up to me and the hierarchy at Deli to make sure that they don't get their hands on them. So,
what's it like working with Big Papi Stoin, Marcus Stoinis?
I love the big fella. I love Stoin. I think hopefully he'd say the same thing about me as well. And I've known him for a long time. I played a little bit of shoe cricket against him at the back end of my career. I'm not sure if I've ever told him this, but the first game I ever saw him play for WA, I rang our state coach at the time and said, "Get this bloke down to." Tassie, he looks like a player
really?
To me. Yeah, I'm not sure if I've ever told Stoin that, but he's
maybe before you go on.
NFL Sunday Ticket is now on YouTube and YouTube TV, which means that you can stay close to your team even if you don't live in their town. Like maybe you're a Raven who married a Seahawk who got a job in the land of the Falcons. With NFL Sunday Ticket, you can watch your team's out-of-market Sunday afternoon games no matter where you live. Because you shouldn't have to change teams, even if you change towns. NFL Sunday Ticket, now on YouTube and YouTube TV. Go to youtube.com/presale to get $50 off.
Terms and embargoes apply. Offer ends 9/19. No refund. Subscription auto-renews.
Just, because we asked Timmy what he thought about you a couple of weeks ago.
Did you?
Yeah.
Could you sort of creep around here without knocking the camera around? Oh, you can get the headphones to Richard.
It should be able to just be able to hear it.
Oh, just be able to hear it? Okay, yeah. We'll just ask him about you, so just before you go on.
I'd send Punter back. And, like, people think he's tough, but I've spent a lot of time with him. He's actually quite mentally fragile. if that gets back to him, that's going to...
No one watches this.
Do you want a headline for the... Ricky Ponting, mentally fragile. You can't, Rick.
I mean, I just...
Can I start again? I'll take it.
It's harsh on him. He was given a hypothetical about, you know, who he'd want to bat with, and then he withdrew it all. I think he was just talking about people that he respects. But, how would you deal with a coach? You know, that's a coaching issue now for you. So
well, he was
is he going to get retained?
No, that's what I was going to say. He was going to be a retention. He's not anymore. He can let someone else, another mentally fragile coach, look after him somewhere else through the IPL. No, look, I love him. He's just, you know, he's a different sort of cat, and everyone will probably say that about him. But when you get to know him and work out how driven he is to be the best player that he can be, and that's the great thing about working in the IPL. You're working with all the best players in the world, and you're trying to find ways to make them a little bit better and challenge them. And that's what I've had to do with him. You know, every moment that I've had with him, I've just tried to make him one little bit better. So he can win games for Delhi. But actually, when he goes back to domestic cricket here, or when he's playing for Australia, that some of the things that we work on will hopefully make him a better player. And if he could just toughen up a little bit mentally, I think he'll be a really good player. He's got some talent.
We've seen some of the all-time great speeches through Delhi's social media channels for you giving speeches before the games, after the games. You know, just makes me want to run through walls for you. I mean, I'd do anything for you anyway. I love you. But
Storm obviously doesn't.
Okay, I'm now playing for Delhi. Yeah, good. Yeah. I've been retained. Third wheel. You know, have you always been a nervous public speaker?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. Well, I certainly was. I don't know if you've ever seen some of the first ever interviews I did down in Tassie as a...
They're good.
Oh, my God.
I've never seen them.
Haven't you?
No.
You should have a look at some of those. I couldn't put two words together and probably not much better now, but...
But some of the speeches during the IPL, I mean, they're awesome. They're unbelievable.
Yeah, and I'm not that comfortable with those things being recorded and sent out. Yeah, like okay. Every time it's done, I do the speech, they record it, they send it to me straight away. I've got to look at it and approve it before it goes out. I'm pretty protective of a lot of the stuff. So a lot of the stuff that I do say, you don't see anyway. Tactical stuff or stuff that I've talked about, the opposition or whatever, that's taken out.
And, yeah.
So you only see the good bits, I guess. Not so much the good bits, the bits that I'm happy to for everyone to see. But one thing I hope you sort of do pick up through those chats, most of the time it's all really positive stuff, regardless if we won or lost. And a lot of the time I'm just trying to pump the boys' tyres up and make them better that way. So, yeah.
I mean, the players rave about you, you know, whenever we talk to them, on air, off air, they love it. Like, I look at you and I just think about how much demand you must be in just as a business property. You know, you have business interests, you're kind to people, you obviously are a legend of the game, you have coaching success, and, you know, your name has been mentioned in dispatches about an Australian coaching role one day. And I just wonder whether the Australian men's team could afford you, not just for money, but for time, you know, because it's 300 days on the road. I know there's talk about splitting white ball, red ball. JL's got the gig at the moment, of course, but, you know, a lot of people would feel very safe with you at the helm of the Australian men's team. But is it something that, given all the other interests you have in life, that you would ever consider?
Time's the only thing that stops it, to be honest, and you're absolutely spot on there. Like, I'd love to coach the Australian cricket team, but for what I've done with my playing career and being on the road as much as I have and being away as much as I have, and I've got a, you know, youngish family now, you know, a 7-year-old boy and and one end and a 13-year-old girl at the other, to give up 300 days a year for me right now is just not what I feel I could do. That's where the IPL works so well for me, you know, to be able to do 8, 9, 10 weeks in the winter months overseas, and then to be able to come back and do the Channel 7 stuff in the summer. You know, I've got enough work there to keep me happy and keep me around the game, but also enough time to be able to spend with the family. So, let's wait and see what they do with, if they do split the teams and whatever up the coaches up amongst the white ball and red ball teams, and see what might eventuate there. But it's, I think everyone would love to be coach of the Australian cricket team, but I actually think now it's the way I look at it anyway, with my personal life, it's almost an older man's job, or someone that's really young and not married and not got family, or someone that's on the other end of it where Justin is now, where he's got, you know, his family are sort of all grown up and mostly moved away, and you know, you're not giving up as much of that side of your life as you normally would. I mean, it's over 300 days a year. Pretty high pressure job as well. You know, Justin's been under pressure since he took over that.
Really?
Yeah, I've noticed that. Yeah. I've read some stuff online about it. Yeah.
And even more so, the last few months. But, you know, that's the only thing that would stop me is the time commitment with it.
Rahul Dravid's just taken over from Ravi Shastri in India. People mentioned you in dispatches for that gig, not just YouTube commenters on us, though there was plenty of them as well. Did you look at that job? Would that job appeal to you? How would you have felt about it?
It's exactly the same. I mean, it's exactly the same amount of time, but I'm living in India for 300 days of the year, which, look, I had a couple of conversations with some people during the IPL about it. You know, and the people that I spoke to were pretty hell-bent on trying to find a way to make it work, because the first thing I said was, I just can't, you know, I can't give up that time. I've got other – that means I can't coach in the IPL. I'd have to give up 7 stuff in the summer. Like, it just can't work. But, you know, it's nice to have people to think that you might be able to do these big jobs, but there's a lot more to come with it than just saying yes or no to a coaching gig.
If Ricky Ponting coaches India, that's – I'm sorry, that's me. I mean, I love you. I'd do anything for you. I've already said that, but –
You got
that
like
would
the,
be the
you
end.
Got the Baiju sort of yeah. thing on, blue.
Big know. Oakley's on.
Yeah. Like that. Oh, I think you'd be fine, but obviously.
Yeah.
Well, I'm surprised that Driver's done it as well, because there was a lot of chat about how happy he was in his under-19 role, I think, or his academy role that he had. And I'm not sure much about his family life or what he's got, but I'm pretty sure he's got youngish kids, at least one anyway. And so I'm surprised that he took it. But I think, as I said, the people that I spoke to they were going to make sure they got exactly the right person, so they've been able to convince Driver to do it.
With the guys you coach now, a lot of them would have watched you play, so you would have been like their idol, I'm sure, to a lot of the guys, right? So you're
Australian, remember? Not too many Indians were looking up to us.
Well, I'm saying like Stoinis, perhaps, you know, for instance, or you know, even Steve Smith or whatever. But like, so you automatically have this sort of you know, this credibility in the bank. Whereas like when you were captain of like the team, when you had the best team, like did you have the same weight of, you know, people's attention in the dressing room when you're giving a pre-game talk, like, or is McGrath throwing grapes at Warne?
Probably a bit of both. I was probably making a speech and McGrath was throwing grapes at Warne at the same time.
Like Ponting stands up and goes, come on boys, we're going to get into him here and blah. Is everyone like eyes on Ricky Ponting?
Yeah, look, I probably talk a lot more now than I did back then.
Okay.
Certainly a lot of the captaincy stuff, when I was captain of the Australian team, it wasn't rah-rah stand-up speeches. It was about spending time with individuals and getting to know them that way. Sort of almost like a, you know, I had to, the biggest part of captaincy for me was understanding people's personalities, because I couldn't stand up in a as captain of a team and make a speech and expect that everyone's going to take on what I said exactly the same way. So it was about, you know, if I had Andrew Simons over there and Justin Langer over there and I'm saying the same speech, both of those guys are going to interpret what I say in completely different ways. It was about spending one-on-one time and breaking down characters and understanding people as well as I could. And then hopefully the respect and time that I'd shown them as individuals, they would then show back to me as captain. And if we did that, then I knew that we'd get some good results on the field.
We joke a lot, Ricky, about how there's like a, you know, like grade cricket or Australian cricket is like a feudal system, like a pyramid, you know, like you're respected according to how many runs you've scored or how many games you've played at the top. Doesn't matter whatever else you are in life, whether you're a good person or whatever, respect is just literally afforded like a pyramid, you know, even like, I'm sort of joking, but even when Haydos was defending JL the other day, he was like, how could we speak like this about a man who's played 100 tests? I'm like, well, how many tests do you need to play to get respect? You know, like it's sort of an invisible economy. Yeah. And yet, you know, you've played the most test, and you seem to be able to treat people very equally. You know, I've played grade cricket with guys who've played with you, and they just can't believe how welcoming and accommodating you were. And you would have then played test cricket with guys who were very much about like, I'm up here, you're down there. We're not going to name any names, but like, so where does that come from with you? You know, like, is that the influence of your parents? Is that a decision that you just made? Because I think the way you treat people, which is completely different to the cricket economy we grew up with, is rare. You know, is that something you've observed, or where does it come from?
It's a good question. I don't know where it comes from. I think it's got to have something to do with your upbringing and your background and my family life and probably my early club cricket days, to be honest. I mean, I was a young kid in a pretty successful Northern Tasmanian senior men's cricket team that had a lot of state players around it, and back then, I knew that every one of those senior guys that were looking at me as a 10-year-old, all that they were thinking about was what was going to be best for me. How could they help me? How could they make me better? You know, and that was the sort of environment that I was around.
That's interesting.
And then for me, it was the same thing. So if any team that I played in, I wanted to make every individual better and make the team better. So the only way I thought I could do that is by treating everyone the same and bringing everyone together on the same journey. I just wanted the best for everybody that I played with. And I think, you know, hopefully people, and I know I said this when I retired, when I spoke to the boys in Perth when I retired, I said to them then that I hope every single one of you guys that I've played in this room now, that I've played with, understand that I just had your back the whole time. I just wanted the best for you as individuals. And because I knew that if I looked after them, then the team would always be okay. So I think it probably does go back to, I just knew that I had a lot of people that were going to do whatever they could to give me the best chance in life or in cricket. And then I've just tried to make sure I've done that the same with everyone that I've played with, whether that's Harbhajan Singh that I captained at Mumbai when I went there. Once we got in the same team, it was whatever we'd done was done, and we're going to go on this together and try.
Good
and
bloke when you get to know him, kind of.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He actually was a good bloke. Yeah.
That's funny how that works. Just on that, Rick, and you've just touched on this. You've obviously had the first experience you had at Mowbray. It's like imprinting theory. It was of older men who actually took you under their wing and encouraged you. That's not what I think most people get when they play grade cricket. I don't understand it at all. Guys just with court jester hats on, they were naked.
You're actually spot on. It doesn't happen in every team. It didn't happen in every team that I played in.
Yeah.
You know, if as a 17-year-old in a Tassie team or a 20-year-old on your first tour for Australia to the West Indies, it didn't always happen that way.
Mm.
But that was, it had happened to me at a young age.
Yeah.
Some of the best things that ever happened in my cricketing life was, like, I'd be a 13-year-old boy playing for Mowbray, having one of the state's fastest bowlers bowling at me and sledging me, and I've got my teammate at the other end that wouldn't stand for that at all. You don't talk to him like that.
How good were you?
Which bowler are you thinking about?
I mean, that's the other thing.
My uncle Greg.
He'd actually moved to he'd moved to Hobart.
Just hooked him.
But those things, they stand out to me because I knew. Yeah, people were just going to stand up for me and look out for me and do the best that they could, and then that's just part of the. So that's just become part of who I am.
That's amazing. I mean, Mowbray has so much to, we've got so much to thank Mowbray for. Nation does.
Clearly.
I just wondered if you also, on the other hand, just alpha, because there's a former teammate of yours, again, anonymous, played a lot of state cricket with you at Tassie, and you'll respect and never reveal sources, but he tells a story about, like, there'd be blokes in the Tassie side who'd make 30 or 40 or something like that. And they'd carry, you know, we've all seen them before. They carry themselves with confidence in the sheds afterwards because, you know, they've made a couple of runs or whatever. And then the 18-year-old Ricky Ponting would just say, "Oh, get a few today, did you?" Is that a Tassie thing? Because it was almost exactly what Tim Payne said to Will Pekowski after making a double ton last year. I just wanted to know if that rings true to your experience, you know, or do you just.
To put the pieces together to work out who this anonymous.
It was said very endearingly, but it was a senior player to you in terms of age, just sort of going like he could be 18 and just say to someone, "Oh, get a few," and just cut them down just in one go, score 30 odd. "Oh, get a few, did you?"
Yeah, I'm not
could
sure
we role play it maybe? Like,
I'm not sure I was ever trying to cut anyone down like that. It was probably just having a, you know, you're right. You knew when guys are pretty happy with themselves, and I think. One thing I also had at Mowbray was those guys that were looking out for me, they were also making sure that I wasn't getting too far ahead of myself.
If I was ever
taking a step, then they'd give me a little pat on the head or drag me back down pretty quickly. And little things like that I might say around that Tassie dressing room would have been that, you know. "Oh, so you're happy with 40, are you?" "Well, you probably shouldn't be happy with 40. Because 30 or 40 is not going to win us too many games." So it might, you know.
How did it sound to actually say, like, "Get a few today, did you?" Like, did you just say that?
Can I just say it again? "Oh, get a few today, did you?"
I just really want to clip that up.
clip it up.
You should never ask for an impression, you know, but... Oh, God.
So much of this is so foreign to me. Like, apparently 40 is not a good score. That's also news to me.
Yeah, that's right.
I understand that.
I remember there was a line in one of your early books where, I think, was it your dad who said, like, "You shouldn't be happy averaging 40 in Shield cricket. What are you even here for?" You know?
Dad used to have a lot of little, well, that's where I've got that, "Oh, get a few today." That's,
it would have come. Said it with the right.
It would have come from him. Because he was always, and, you know, Dad was never hard on me.
Yeah.
But I remember some of the early, you know, junior days or whatever, you know, I'd come home and, "Oh, how many did you get today, mate?" "Oh, 180, Dad." "Be like, why didn't you get 200?
Fuck.
You know, it'd be something like that. Or I remember one of the first ever games of junior footy I played, under 13s footy. First, like, for the NTJFA, like, so for North Launceston. I'd only ever played school footy before that, whatever. I kicked five goals. First game under 13, I kicked five goals. I must have had 50-odd kicks. And same thing, I came home that day and said, "Dad said, oh, how'd you go?" I said, "Yeah, pretty good. Got a few kicks and kicked five goals." And it was like, "Why don't you kick six goals?" I just can't do anything. Just can't do anything right. But that's, so that's probably where it...
But did you
168.
Did you feel like he was proud of you, you know, ultimately with all the runs that you scored?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he might have ended up being pretty proud. I mean, the story I tell about him is, well, that I rang him from Perth the day before my last test, and I said, "Dad, time's up. I'm retiring tomorrow or at the end of the game. He said, what are you talking about, bloody idiot? Just go and get some runs in this game and everything will be fine. I said,
and play 200 tests.
Yeah. I'm done. Yeah. I made this decision. No, but he couldn't. Yeah. He couldn't accept it. He wanted his son to keep playing for Australia as long as he could. Cool.
Yeah. Sachin played 200 tests.
Yeah. He left a few in the bank, actually.
Yeah.
Mate, cool. I actually saw... Look, I'm sorry. I'm taking over a bit here. But before you retired, or you had the final series against South Africa and you hung him up, I was working at Telstra in Melbourne. There's a big tower there. You can see the MCG from it. We're up high and Victoria was playing Tasmania in a Shield game. And I just skived off work at about 2 o'clock or something. And I went down and I watched you score one of the great hundreds against Pattinson and Siddle and these guys. And Alex Doolan was at the other end. And I think he'd batted 3 for Australia or whatever. And I mean,
just about to think. I think he got 102, didn't he, or 90?
Yeah, yeah. And with respect to Alex, there were two different players, at either end. And you just looked in such great touch against two test bowlers. And then, the common story is like, Steyn and Morkel had their way with Ricky Ponting and it was time to go. I mean, I just saw that innings in Perth, just sat there by myself like a really cool guy. And I was like, mate, Ponting can still play big time.
It was pretty flat that day though, so.
It must have been. Yeah. If I got runs that summer, it must have been flat. No, look, that was the end of the day. I was batting as well as ever. That last summer. Like, I was the leading run scorer in Shield cricket for the year.
And
I had 3 bad games for the year. They were 3 test matches. And what that said to me was that, I mean, at the end of the day, I was batting no differently. I was just trying so bloody hard. I couldn't let it go. I knew the end was closer than the start. I wanted to make sure I was doing everything as well as I possibly could for the younger blokes in the Aussie team as well. I mean, realistically, I think I've said this to you guys before. I should have retired probably 2 years before I did. Mm. That was, I mean, I was on a decline for 2 years before I actually retired. But I wanted to be around that Aussie team for Warner and Smith and Johnson and Haddon and that younger group that were coming in. I wanted to be around that team to help those guys through the initial parts of their career. So I sort of dragged myself through it a little bit for what I thought was going to be the right thing for the Australian cricket team. I'd never trained so hard, really. Like, for every preseason I had, I'd work my back. So I was fitter than I'd ever been before. And all those little things were just, it was just, as I said, I just couldn't let go. I just tried way too hard, put too much pressure on myself to do everything perfectly. And I got to the stage where I'd go out in a Shield game, not even think about getting out. It was only about going out and getting runs. But I'd go out in a test match, and the first thing I was worried about was not getting out.
Mm.
So therefore, I was thinking about not getting out rather than scoring runs, and that's a bad place to be. You know, that's what any of these young, or not young guys, even David Warner. I've spoken to Davey the last few weeks since the end of the IPL, and he didn't get off to the greatest start in this World Cup. But I said, mate, I'll guarantee you one thing: you're thinking about not getting out when you're going out to bat. Don't think about not getting out. Think about hitting the first ball for 6 or hitting the first ball for 4. And when you think about the game that way, it becomes a lot easier. When you're worried about failing, it becomes really difficult. And that's where I was. That's where I was the last couple of years that I played. And I was able to do it at Shield level because it wasn't that big a deal if I missed out there. But when I got to the Australian team, I wanted to show all of those young blokes how hard you had to work and what you had to do and how disciplined you had to be. And that was, for me, that just was the wrong way to go about it.
Has Warner got, I'm going to ask you, has Warner got more runs than him? I know you're going to say yes. But like, what happened in the IPL with...
Sunrisers.
Thank you. Sunrisers, yeah, was really bizarre because he's had such a great 6 years in a row, over 600 runs or whatever. Yep. Like, but I suppose there's been a little bit of a downward trajectory with him the last couple of years, but you're back in for more runs this summer in Australia?
I don't think it was lack of runs that kept him out of that Sunrisers team. I think he must have upset someone there somewhere.
Okay.
And it had to be the owners. He made some comments at the start of the tournament about how they got all the selections wrong for one game. I think it was against Rajasthan. Davey got 50-odd in that game,
and then
he made some comments after it. And I think he might have got dropped for the next game and didn't play again. So even the last game of the season this year, Kane Williamson didn't play. He missed out, and they still didn't bring Davey back for the last game, having been there for 6. So he's obviously upset someone, and I haven't spoken about it. But if he's in the – I've said this to him as well. He's going to be in the big auction next year. There'll be a lot of teams that will be looking for David Warner.
Yeah.
And they'll spend a lot of money on him because his IPL record is – really, I think he's the third or fourth highest run scorer, isn't he?
One of the greats.
Amazing, yeah. Yeah. Was that also part of the thing? Obviously, it was so hard for you guys to get basically Shahzad out of the IPL this year. Then you got you got done by CSK in that first game by a guy who's now legally blind, MS Dhoni. You know, like, how does he keep doing that? I mean, how old's Dhoni? Is he 40?
He's up there.
He's up there. Yeah. And he came into the end and he scored, what, 20 off not many balls.
It was his only knock all year.
Only knock all year, yeah.
Thanks for reminding me.
Yeah. Oh, you guys were the best team all tournament. Yeah.
And then KK got him at Sharjah. And
yeah, we did that. The draw didn't work out that well for us. I mean, we had our chance against CSK. We should have won that game. We had gone straight into the final. But it was a really disappointing way for us to end. The last three games we played, the last round game against RCB, they needed 9 off 2 balls.
Mm.
They got 2 off the second last ball. They did 7 to win off the last ball of the game. Avish Khan bowls a leg side wide.
Mm.
6 to win. Knee high full toss last ball. Over long on 6. That's how we lost that one.
Mm.
Then we lost the next one against Chennai. I think they needed 20 odd off the last 2 overs.
Yeah.
We had Tom Curran or Rabada left to bowl the last over. Mm. We chose to bowl Tom Curran the last over.
We did, yep.
Yeah, that's right. We did. I saw the post-game speech there.
Yeah. We did. Yeah. And then, the Calcutta game. I mean, I'm not sure if you guys watched that, but we didn't. Sharjah was never going to be a good place to play there with the three spinners that they had.
Game,
and they
yeah.
played a lot of their cricket there. But even with that game, I think they needed 12 off 25 balls, I think. And then they needed 6 off 2.
Yeah.
They hit the second last ball for 6. So, it was a. We were. I said this to the boys at the end. I still think we were the best team in the tournament. As good as Chennai were, and they went on obviously to win it again, I think we were the best team. We just had a couple of critical mistakes and critical moments that we made at the end, which is the difference in winning and losing T20 games and the difference in winning or losing tournaments.
We
made those mistakes.
I think part of my excitement, not just because my team Australia is playing against, so I get to watch them, but like just cricket outside of the UAE for the first time in like what feels like 6 months is exciting because UAE looks like a grim place to go and play cricket. I mean, I'm not sure what I expect you to say to that. Other than I actually watched a clip of you facing Mohammed Sami. Batting in a baggy green, he bumped you. That was in Sharjah. Mm-hmm. And he hit you on the chin.
Yep. That day, it was 55 degrees.
That's right,
air temperature.
Was that the game where Australia, they bowled Pakistan for like 50 and 53?
Yeah, we batted first. I think we got close to 400. Matty Hayden batted for the whole day, got 100. And I got out before lunch and basically got carried off the field. I got halfway off, got a cramp in my calf.
Mm.
Took another step, got a cramp in my other calf. Oh. Got a cramp in my hammy, got a cramp in my other hammy. I literally got carried off the ground and I batted for about an hour and a half. It was unbelievably hot.
Yeah.
I mean, I got hit, as you said, with a baggy green on because it was actually too hot to wear a helmet. You couldn't wear a helmet.
Really?
So everyone was batting in caps because it was just so hot.
Yeah.
There's footage of the guys at the non-strikers end that were curled up, hiding in the shadow that was created by the umpire. The boys are hiding in the
slipstream.
Fucking hell.
It was unbelievable.
55. Yeah.
So they're bringing out tables and chairs and stuff for the drinks breaks. And so
No
crazy, good. But Haydos, I know he did it, but he batted all day.
Yeah.
We were just talking about the IPL before. Australians, I think, have a hazy relationship to the IPL. We're all told and we know that it's the best competition and it pays the most money, but at the same time, and we joke about it, it's on at the wrong times for Australians and the jerseys look weird and the sponsors, they're foreign to us. And so we just, the lights are dim, so we don't acknowledge it. But then when anybody does watch it, you realise it's really the big deal. And like and we know that there are Indian players coming through, but we don't know any of their names and stuff. Like who are the young Indians of the next generation coming through that you just think, these guys are unbelievable. They really impress you.
Well, we've got one. We've got Prithvi Shaw, who we saw a little bit in Australia last summer.
He looks amazing.
Technically, in Australia last summer, he wasn't ready for
You got him out, cricket. Actually, just before the first ball.
Yeah, that's how that works, right? So I've never spoken to anyone in the Australian cricket team about how they should bowl to guys that I coach.
Why?
Yeah.
But when I got on
air. You're a spy.
And when I got on air and I said, just before the first ball, actually. Shape one back in. I get all these calls from, you're telling all these secrets on our boys. And I haven't said a word. I just said it on TV and it happened the way.
Wait, Stark swinging it into a right hander.
Stark swinging it at 150. It's going to do some damage.
But he
Prithvi Shaw looks amazing.
He is an exceptional talent.
He looks good.
I mean,
the start of his
IPL, the first part of the tournament in India this year, was as good as I've ever seen anyone bat.
We were losing it.
Over just through the offside. Just
front and back foot. Yeah. The way he picks the bat up, he plays a short ball probably better than most Indians as well because he's prepared nice and early and he's got a high back lift and good wrist cock and whatever else. Mm. Yeah, I still remember that game in Chennai. We're playing a really slow, low-turning wicket in Chennai against Calcutta.
Mm-hmm.
And when we got there, I'd sort of said to the boys, I've mapped out a pretty clear game plan of what I wanted to get in the power play. And, let's make sure we're, none or one down for 40 and then we'll get 60 through the next eight overs and then we'll get to 140 and that's going to be enough.
Yeah.
He hit six fours off the first over. Pretty well, against one of his under-19 teammates. He just absolutely destroyed him. I think there's a white in there as well. We're none for 25 off the first over, so I'm sending messages out. Don't worry about being none for 40. Keep going now. Not sure if you saw the young kid, Gay Quad from Chennai.
Yeah. Because we talked to Watto was on our show weekly.
Yeah. Well, he would have pumped up the Chennai boys, Watto.
Oh, he loved it. Yeah. No, big Chennai guy.
MS Dhoni, good apparently.
Yeah, that's right. he talked about Gay Quad as well. But he looked amazing.
He looks the business, Leading run scorer.
Venkatesh Iyer, opened for Calcutta the back half of the season. He's a real talent.
Came from nowhere as well.
He didn't play the first half. Yep. And
shirt out, no lid.
Yeah, that's him, And end up bowling some overs as well. He's an all-rounder. I spoke to Brendan McCullum about him, actually, in the first part of the tournament. I saw him batting in the nets with us one day, and I said to Brendan, who's this kid? He's not playing. He said, no, can't get him in at the moment and whatever else, and... And after that break, they came back with almost completely different theory on how they wanted to play, and it was a bit more Brendan's way with going really hard at the top. So they got this kid in at the top, and he was very good. Obviously, there's Patakul at RCB. He's a really good young opening batter as well. Rajasthan have got a kid called Jaiswal, who's an opener as well.
You mentioned all these younger guys, Ricky, and like the current Indian side. They're full of superstars and legends and stuff. They didn't get past the group stage of the T20 World Cup. Okay, you make a couple of mistakes and you're gone. It's pretty unforgiving. But we watched a lot of these guys you're talking about, and they play bright, attacking, aggressive cricket. I mean, do you think the Indian side needs to look at regenerating to get some of these guys in? Because it always feels like India's coming up so strong. We talk about the Asian century, that the younger guys could be better than the current guys.
Yeah, I think... they were just exhausted.
Yeah.
I mean, their run, what they've had,
yeah.
And you've got to understand where they've been. I mean, their whole country's been in lockdown, right? So any cricket they've – and then they've – last year's IPL in the UAE, they went straight back home. They played their domestic cricket at home. They then went to England in between this. They come from England straight into another bubble in the UAE, play there. They go straight into the World Cup.
Mm.
They've got New Zealand, I reckon, about 2 days after.
2 days after, yeah.
2 days after the World Cup.
Unbelievable.
They had Ishan Kishan in that squad, didn't they? They had Surya Kumar in that squad. Yep. They're starting to bring a few younger guys in. Shreyas Iyer was around. He was one of the emergencies around the squad. But you're not going to push Rohit Sharma out. You're not going to push Virat out. You're not going to push KL Rahul out. They had Hardik Pandya in there maybe a little bit, if he's not bowling, maybe they could use another batter in that middle order, maybe another one of those younger blokes. But, there's just so many of them. There's so many good young players that one of their senior guys doesn't go so well, you think, are they better putting these young blokes in? But they've got too many. And that's what makes it. That's why these questions come up. They've got so many really good young players.
Yeah. Well, we've got Travis Head and Khawaja, so it bounces it up.
good
players as well.
They're good players.
Australia going to Pakistan. Well, hopefully. First time in 24 years. You were there the last time.
When is that scheduled for?
March.
First week of March. You got something on? you got to move some stuff around? Yeah.
Yes, I don't think I'll be going on that tour.
Okay. No. But obviously I want to ask you about the last time we were there, one of the most famous one for 13 off five overs, your one for getting Moeen Khan out. But also in that game...
Reverse swing out.
I don't know how a guy got zero on that deck, because Australia got 500, 600, then Pakistan got 600. It's a game that Mark Taylor got 334, not out. And you were batting with him at the time, and you missed out that day. You only got 76, I think.
Not out.
Red ink, sorry. When you walked off the field, he just finished on 334. He tried to get the 335th, but he missed out. But did you wait for him to say, well batted, Rick, or did you say it first, or how did that... play out on that day when you walked
off
the field?
All I said to him that night was, whatever you do, you're not declaring overnight.
Oh, really? Yeah. You told him not to?
Because I was out of the side. I'd come back in for that game. Yeah. I was pretty keen to get 100.
Oh, so
I was
okay, like, right.
No, don't worry about Bradman's record, mate. Just keep bat. We'll bat on tomorrow for the first session, and then we can declare it later with lunch.
Do you think times have changed?
You told Mark Taylor to bat on so you can score 100.
I thought you were going down the path of like, no, you know, Tubby, make sure you get past Bradman, but you just wanted to.
Well, and I didn't play the next test.
Okay.
Ah, the unwritten story.
I looked up of
Taylor's declaration.
I didn't play the next test.
Okay, that was your 19th test. I don't know what I want you to do with that, but I thought you were more established than that. You were, but obviously not.
I think so. I think I might have come in for Boof. I think Boof might have played the game before, got injured. I come in for that game. Boof was right for the next one, so I went back out again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Came in as the all rounder.
I don't know why I was bowling. Must have been flat.
It was pretty flat.
It must have been flat.
I think that's...
That's bang on the hour. Ricky Ponting, what a pleasure. We've been... we're extremely grateful that we'd have you in the studio. Great to be able to talk about Ponting Wines as well.
We didn't get to crack one, did we?
Yeah, well... And we should say, I mean, we're trying to be as authentic as we can on the show. But
yeah, we have drunk them.
We
not these bottles here. We've had them before. They're good.
There was the talk about actually cracking them open, but it truly is 9 a.m. and we all just went, you know, we had a blowout on Saturday and it wasn't looking good. But yeah, I've got note. I mean, the Sauv Blanc, you know, I have had it before. Fresh and floral notes, obviously. Yeah, fresh and floral.
You're reading the back of the bottle.
No, not at all. Oh. Zesty passion fruit. Great little grapefruit nose on that one.
I tell you what, I had a rosé the other day, and because I had a bit of a blowout, but like Pez was asking me like why did that happen? I just started talking about the weather.
Yeah,
I was just saying like how, and like I started with a rosé that day, and it was just the perfect accompaniment to like a nice summer sitting on the balcony.
Well, this is the Rihanna rose.
She's pretty happy. She's got a name on the front of one of the bottles.
It's gently perfumed, crisp finish. So
yeah,
it's been good fun though. I must admit, this whole business venture for Rihanna and I to be involved in our own business together has been great, especially through COVID times where it hasn't been, you know, it hasn't been that easy to break into big retailers and stuff. But, but with, you know, some of our direct online sales have been really strong, and when the kids have been in one room getting their homeschooling done, it's been good for Anna and I to have something that we're really passionate about to be able to work on together and on a daily basis. So it's that's been good. The product is outstanding. Our winemaker in South Australia, Ben Riggs, has done an amazing job. We try to tell a story through the range as well. So it's you notice there's two Tasmanian wines in the range, a Pinot and a Chardonnay, both from northern suburbs of Tassie. So yeah, that's what we're trying to do. Like the only issue we've had sort of with the wine so far is that a lot of people think it's just a celebrity brand and he's thrown his name on the front of a bottle and then, you know, run away from it and hope to make some money out of it. It's not that for us at all. It's the exact opposite. The fact that it has got a name on it makes us work even harder because we need to be fully invested and we want the brand obviously to be as successful as possible. And the other guys in the business with us, I've said to them, I said, this is the success of this business will come down to longevity. You know, how long we can maintain and sustain really good high level product in the marketplace, which is a pretty competitive marketplace too, I must admit, is how I'll judge the business anyway. So it's been great so far, and onto our second and third vintages now. So it's very young business, we're not even 2 years established yet, but it's been great fun. Yeah.
It's quite classy. I would have thought of like a baggy green wearing like grizzled legend of the game to be in the wine business, you know, because you normally attach beer, you know, to cricketers. How do the Mowbray guys, you know, feel about the fact that one of their own is now hawking wine? And is it your dream one day, you know, after the day's play, that cricketers are now cracking open a Rihanna Rosé to celebrate?
So I can guarantee you, in the eyes of every Mowbray cricketer that's ever played, I've done two things wrong in my career. One was blow my wife a kiss when I got a double 100 in Adelaide against India, and the second one was to start my own wine label.
Not manly or something? Is that what
you love
about?
Your wife, do you? That's quite
how
a weakness.
Affection.
How many Mowbray boys do you think have actually had a glass of Pinot at the end of a day's play? Not too many.
I reckon they would have, but just not told you about it.
The Pinot is called the Mowbray boy. So that's once again with the story that we're trying to tell is. You talk to anyone about me in Tasmania, how would they describe me? They'd say he's a Mowbray boy. So that's the name of that one. And Sauvignon Blanc is the first session, which the a Sauvignon Blanc sort of the start of our range, if you like, first session, the start of a test match, how important the first session might
crack
be.
Crack it open in the first session, 10 a.m.
I don't need to tell you boys how important the first session is, but that's what we've tried to create through this, is storytelling as much as anything through the range. And labelling, as you said, looks like a baggy green colours, the gold. This is supposed to represent creams.
Safety. It looks premium.
All of that, safe. All of that stuff, mate.
Yeah. Tamar Valley, that one, isn't it? Spicy cherries and sort of quite a structured one. That's all good.
That's all good.
I knew you were reading it from somewhere.
No, I wasn't.
Well, that's pontingwines.com if you want to get yourself a little... A little slice of
last rookie. Year, we actually had a code. I don't know if you knew this, but the code, I don't think it exists now, but it was Get A Few. Just after that story. So we do our own sort of storytelling
get
as well.
Get A Few today, did you? like that.
You said it three times. Ricky Ponting, thanks so much for joining us. A huge pleasure. We'll never not be grateful for these opportunities. And to come up to TGC Towers is particularly special as well. All the best with Ponting Wines. Summer ahead. Hope you get some time with your family and a bit of a rest as well.
I might see you down the beach with my Aussie shorts on again.
He's no every chance if I saw you on the beach and I said g'day, he'd be like, who are you? Yeah.
Thanks, boys. Thanks for having me.